Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Monday, February 12th, 2018. The time is 9 a.m. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, on the fifth floor in the Senate Finance Committee room. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me is Co-Chairman Lyman Hoffman.
Good morning.
Senator Bishop.
Good morning.
Our Vice Chairman, Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning.
Senator Machicki.
Good morning.
Senator Stevens and Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome all. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? For those, again, following off net or online, on Friday, we did not complete a presentation from Devin Mitchell, our debt manager. So if you're looking for the document, it's titled 2018 Credit Review and State Debt Summary, and it has Mr. Mitchell's name on it. We just completed page 12. And we are getting ready to go over the state debt rate rating overview. Slide 13 is where we left off. Mr. Mitchell, if you would come to the microphone. The presentation is up and queued. Identify yourself for the record, and then please continue.
Thank you. Devin Mitchell, debt manager for the state of Alaska. And as you said, we're on page 14.
Mr. Mitchell.
Yes.
And my staff rightly pointed out it wasn't Friday that we stopped before you finished. It was Wednesday, so if folks are looking for a date, it was Wednesday, a continuation. Please continue, Mr. Mitchell.
Great. So this is kind of the story of the past that we've both enjoyed. I mean, it's like a tale of the best of times, the worst of times. 2010 to 14, we were as a state, high flyers, if you will. We had large capital budgets, surpluses, growing reserves. Our unrestricted general fund revenue exceeded our unrestricted general fund expenditures, and we were able to increase our credit rating to the highest credit ratings available, AAA. And then 2015 to 2017, the price of oil, of course, started declining in the second half of calendar year 2014, and that led to a number of changes. We diminished, as a state, diminished unrestricted general fund expenditures. We used pre-funding, like education pre-funding was the largest example of that, was used. We've used reserves like the statutory budget reserve, initially, and then the constitutional budget reserve, and there's been diminished capital budgets, minimalistic capital budgets, which has always been a budgetary tool to offset the volatility of the price of oil within state budgeting. And then we had some additional changes that we hadn't seen in the past with the discontinuation of the statutory dividend payment. We went to a 50% of the statutory dividend approximately payment in 2017, and then again in 2018. And then we also have had a lot of discussion about various tax proposals and ways of balancing our unrestricted general fund spending and unrestricted general fund revenue. We received four downgrades during that time frame, with three additional downgrades in FY18, two of those right after the end of the summer's last special session, and then one additional downgrade by Fitch, which I thought was a little more thoughtful, but in November. In the latest year, we've started really working on, based on investor feedback and our perception of the rating agency's reports, the strengths of Alaska that are inherent that tend to be ignored when there's a change afoot. And so the one of the largest of the state's strengths is the Alaska Permanent Fund, which has only been used historically to provide dividends and otherwise has just been a growing fund balance, which is, again, the toolbox analogy, kind of the biggest, shiniest tool in the toolbox, but nobody wants to put a scratch on it. And so we started suggesting that the state was more like an endowed university than our contemporaries. Like we discussed the last time, rating agencies have scorecards for state credits, and so they have different metrics, different categories of determining rating strength that they try to homogenize all of the different states into. And so comparing Alaska to like a state of Washington that has a sales tax or a state of Oregon that has an income tax is, in my view, extraordinarily difficult. We don't have a broad-based tax at this point in the state of Alaska. We've been able to generate the majority of our unrestricted general fund revenue from oil production. And we have then, in addition to that, an endowment, a permanent fund with an incredible amount of assets in it at this point that creates a natural offset potential to that volatility that we've experienced historically with oil. And is there a question?
We have multiple questions. Okay. Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, ma'am. I got it written down. I'll hold to the end.
Okay. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Mr. Mitchell, I think we talked about this before. When we went through your bond debt analysis that came out in January 2000, was it earlier, a year ago, one of the questions that I'd asked you before is, I said, is your debt analysis take into account a potential POMV from the permanent fund, i.e. raising our bond capacity? And you said, your reply to me was at the time, no, the POMV is not factored into your bond capacity analysis. And, of course, you couldn't give me a number at the time, but you indicated that if we do pass a POMV, that will change the calculation and open up possibilities and opportunities for us. Did you want to comment on that and update that? That conversation took place about 6 months ago.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. I would still agree with that. We aren't including, for purposes of determining debt capacity, any changes, any structural changes to the permanent fund. But as far as our rating and strength of credit that the state has, the ability of the state to pay its bills, we've made an active push to have a shift in how the rating agencies look at the state to include it, since they have historically said, oh, you have that permanent fund, but it's just for dividends. And we kind of acknowledge it's there, but we're really focused on your reserves and the CBRF or the statutory budget reserve, which in my view, that's been historically great that we've had that strength to have that limited perspective. But at this time, it was becoming apparent that views in the marketplace needed to be better informed as to the real strength of the state.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you for that explanation. So credit rating has been sentimentality is beginning to kind of change a little bit with credit rating by recognizing the permanent fund. But in terms of bond capacity, that really has not been incorporated yet, or at least in a hypothetical pro forma setting, because a POMV has not been passed yet.
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mitchell, you mentioned that we are like many of the large endowed universities in the country, and now there's a great fear among universities like Harvard and others that they, under the new tax laws, are going to be taxed heavily. Is there something we should be worried about in that respect?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, the changes that might impact universities are going to be different than those that would impact a state. Certainly, changes at the federal level, anything that would involve changing the tax status of the permanent fund, everybody should be concerned about, of course, because we're a tax-exempt investor, so we don't pay a tax on the investment income that the state earns. And when we borrow money, we can borrow money on a tax-exempt basis, and the investors who borrow money or lend us their money aren't subject to federal income taxation on that income. And so those financial opportunities are important to protect, but I'm not aware of any change due to the tax law the recent tax law change that would have impacted us.
Thank you.
So the next slide is a summary of the three rating agencies that rate the state of Alaska. Moody's has us at the lower of the three ratings at AA3 stable. And that stable is really the stable that's there, and with Fitch has really been the turning of the corner, if you will, from just strictly a debt management perspective with the state of Alaska. We've been on negative outlook since 2015 with all three rating agencies. Negative outlook has a definition for each one of the rating agencies. It generally means some probability of downgrade within a certain period of time, typically like 12 months. And so it's signaling to the market that there's a likelihood of credit deterioration. And by it being stable, it implies that credit stability, which is, of course, what you want when you're talking to folks about them lending you their money. Standard & Poor's still has us at AA negative. In conversations with the analyst, I believe it's likely that all things being equal, if the state proceeds as it has the last couple of years, there's a strong potential that we would be able to get that rating. Negative outlook adjusted to stable as well. And so what that means is there's recognition of the efforts of the legislature and the governor to diminish spending, to have many, many conversations about the issues before the state, the financial issues before the state, recognition of the revenue options that are available to the state, including obviously just on an order of magnitude basis, the permanent fund potential far exceeds that of the other options available to the state, just dollars and cents. But in addition to the permanent fund, the untapped economy that we have at this point with no broad-based tax in the state, that's obviously an unusual thing for the states that they rate. And then that argument that Alaska is more like an endowed university than other states, that we do have this ability to provide supplementary revenue on a targeted basis, and that supplementary revenue is really pretty unrelated to the local economy or the commodity that generates the majority of our other revenue at this point. We talked about the quote-unquote upgrades with the change in outlook, and then kind of the negatives, the downgrades by Moody's and S&P right after the summer special session, then Fitch November 1st. And then there's still historic concerns. If you read our rating agency reports, they talk about our narrow economy that is in recession and some of the pension fund liability issues, and then an over-reliance on oil production, which we try to offset, and we have a couple of slides later in the presentation that show that.
Senator Michiki.
So you probably are more aware than anyone of the check sheet that a rating agency is going to have before them that might change from stable to positive or negative to stable. How important is the simple passage of a POMV in recognition that brings us within a couple to a few hundred million of matching revenues with expenses?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, that would be a very important shift. We've, in my view, been able to make some progress in our rating discussion based on, I mean, we're really kind of stretching to get to positive things to say about the state with all of the concerns that are so often expressed, both in this purview of the legislature as well as in the press. And that's, there hasn't been a lot of positive news coming out of Alaska from a fiscal perspective. And so we've been having to dig through all of that noise to get to the potential positive. And a POMV's passage is, it's like, you know, the shining light would come on all of a sudden. It would be something very positive, I think, from that perspective.
Other questions from committee members? If not, please proceed.
So this next section is some excerpts from a rating agency presentation from October. And so we tried to learn our lesson from the downgrades that occurred right after the end of the summer special session and get out in front a little bit with discussions about where the state was since we had another special session that involved proposed revenue generation along with some criminal law reform. But generally, the executive summary, we went over some of the budget reductions that have occurred, the existing revenues, an evolving but stable reserve position, and that's a key consideration as well in our discussions where there's been a focus on the constitutional budget reserve and the statutory budget reserve while it was funded that implied the sentence that I saw the most that was the most troubling was dwindling reserve position. That would be in a rating agency report on a regular basis, which the fact is there's been an evolution of reserve position. And so if you just looked at what's available for leadership of this state, the legislature, the executive branch to utilize, while it might be politically unpopular, the earnings reserve has grown at about the same rate that our other reserves have been depleted. And so the reserve position, and in particular, if you excluded the $3 billion transfer from the CBRF to the pension trusts in 2015, has been fairly static. It's about the same. And so that's been a cornerstone of the discussions that we've been having as far as stability goes for the state of Alaska. Let's see. So progressively closer to a long-term solution is the last item. And again, there's been a lot of discussion about the need for a statutory fiscal plan or else we're out of luck. We're not going to be able to make it as a state. And you'd read that concept in rating agency reports and hear it in the press a lot. And the reality, again, in my view, and which is very narrow, was that we were moving progressively closer to a long-term solution. There's been budget reductions. There's been adjustments to what's paid to residents in a permanent fund dividend. That one was, in my view, a fairly extraordinary action. We've had retention of liquidity within the earnings reserve by not having statutory inflation proofing. And I would argue that there still is inflation proofing to the permanent fund as there's constitutional deposits of royalty revenue still flowing into the permanent fund at the same time that the additional inflation proofing of on a statutory basis wasn't occurring. And all that does, statutory inflation proofing, is move money from being available in the earnings reserve of the permanent fund to being in the principal category of the permanent fund. So it's in the permanent fund either way. It's just liquidity. Is it available in the event you needed it? And in one instance it is, and then the other it's not. And from a credit perspective, liquidity is good. Let's see. I don't know if there's – we've discussed some of this before, you know, that there's been at times difficulty in seeing the common ground between the various political factions that exist within Alaska and that, in my view, there has been some common ground despite that. And this is, again, messaging that we've had with rating agencies, that there has been some common ground despite the difficulty of trying to find it. And that's that we pull that out by the governor's veto of the permanent fund dividend not being overridden by the legislature, the fact that then both bodies of the legislature last year did pass versions of the budget using permanent fund earnings, that those little actions, even though they aren't the final actions, do demonstrate that there is common ground and that people recognize potential solutions, even though they have different visions of how they might ultimately be implemented.
Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
No.
Please continue.
And this next slide, again, is it's a point in time, and it's got some assumptions in it that are arguably either optimistic or pessimistic, depending on your view. But what this slide is intended to do is, in our state forecasting, we continue in the revenue sources book to forecast, which is the book that Tax Division and the Department of Revenue puts together to project what revenues might be available to provide for government into the future in the current year. And we have this unrestricted general fund category, which is what everybody focuses on, and that's about the fifth or sixth line down. And then you compare that to unrestricted general fund expenses, and that's what yields you a deficit. So, for example, this is based on the spring forecast, so it's dated. This is just right out of our presentation from October. So it's using spring revenue sources book data, and it's showing that there's a projected deficit for FY18 at that time of $2.5 billion. At the same time, there's projections of other revenue that are available to the state for any purpose, but that are considered restricted in that book. And so running through them, there are the next, five or six lines, the CBRF investment earnings projection, which for 2018 was $61.5 million. The CBRF oil and gas dispute resolution, $100 million. The permanent fund fiscal year net assigned change, which is projected by the permanent fund at $846 million. And then the permanent fund in their projections still assumes in every future year that there will be a full statutory dividend and that there will be full statutory inflation proofing. So we backed that out because we saw the practice of the last 2 years and want to extrapolate what would happen if the legislature just continued doing what it's been doing. And so we backed out half of the permanent fund dividend statutory calculation and said that's going to remain in reserves and be available, and that we said there's not going to be permanent fund statutory inflation proofing. That amount's going to remain in the earnings reserve and be available. And if you add that up for FY18, it's $2,696,000,000, which leads to a $191.6 million surplus. And that leads to a slight increase in the total reserve position. And that's what this projects into the future. It's got, again, an optimistic, I'm sure by almost all perspectives, general fund expense line, which is held static at $4.35 billion. It has then some older revenue sources information that would be updated, and so whatever those changes might be. It also isn't accurately depicting the impacts of potential draws on the permanent fund. So the permanent fund is assuming there's a full dividend, and so they're assuming that more money is going out the door for dividends, but they're not assuming anything is going to get used for any other purpose, that it's all going to be retained. And so the net-net of that is that there would be additional draws on the permanent fund than they're currently projecting, so there'd be some correlated diminishment of their annual average earnings expectation into the future. But in this scenario, we can hold it up and say, well, the total reserve balance actually improves through 2026 if those assumptions were to become the reality. And I think this slide is probably one of the key components with us being able to get the stable or the negative removed from our rating and the stable implemented.
Senator Hermachicki.
Yeah, thank you. It's a very helpful slide. It's sort of how I try to look at the big picture, including the total reserve balance at the bottom. Is it a lot of work if we were to have this slide updated with the fall forecast or perhaps the forthcoming spring forecast?
So to be clear, through the chair, Senator Hermachicki, this isn't an official forecast. This is something that Ryan Williams, who's sitting behind me, and I put together to portray the strength of the state to those that are having a difficult time sifting through the official forecasts, because this isn't the plan, if you will. This is just a potential. And so we can update this and implement the fall forecast, but it's still just going to be us throwing some numbers on a page that aren't necessarily something that should be relied upon. They're just an example of what might be possible.
Mr. Mitchell, is it fair to say that whenever you're selling yourself somewhere, that you always put your best foot forward? So this is an optimistic light, and should all things go the same, it's one way to look at our finances. I think about when you go to buy a car, you might not tell them that you're struggling to make your next car payment, but you've made them all on time. Your kids didn't eat that week, but you know, you're keeping your credit rating up. And I don't mean to be flip. Senator Michicki rightly points out that there is optimism to be looked at in Alaska's future, but it does depend on the willingness of legislative bodies to come together and make good decisions for the people of Alaska. Senator Michicki, did you have a follow-up on that?
No, thank you. I understand both of your points, and I agree wholeheartedly. However, it does give us a snapshot. I mean, we could escalate the general fund expense at 2.25% if we want to. We can plug it in, but it would be helpful to see this even with the fall forecast numbers, and then we can adjust so that we're not just looking at the positive. We have to evaluate in a range.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. And I did notice that our Director of Finance, David Teal, got up after the presentation of this particular slide and grabbed the document. So I'm sure that we can get a perspective from our non-Potterton legislative finance team also. Again, it's choosing a particular set of scenarios or criteria. And if you choose just the positive ones, we can make things look really good. And if you choose just the negative ones, we can make things look pretty bad. But all in all, Mr. Mitchell, I think you fairly reported to the credit rating agencies that Alaskans, legislators, are trying to come together and, where we can, reach compromise, do what's best for Alaska. One of the things under the cuts that isn't called out is that we actually passed significant pieces of legislation in some cases to reduce the budget. Community revenue sharing to community assistance was a $30 million reduction in state statute changes that both bodies agreed to. Both bodies agreed to suspension, a moratorium on allowing a debt reimbursement to local communities for school bonds. That's, we know, a hardship to those local communities, but we have tried to work across party lines and across bodies to do what is best. You know, from a Senate perspective, we have tried to do in order of magnitude what we think is best first, which is why the Senate on multiple years has passed a POMV model to the other body for consideration, and we continue to try to work across party lines and across bodies to come up with something that both bodies could agree to. Senator Michicki.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Just wanted to point out that this does have numbers that have projections for oil price that are lower than the current. It has production that's lower than the, I don't know that it's particularly rosy. I think there's a little bit of both, right? So that's why I ask if updated, and we think about that range that we keep talking about so that we're prepared if there is a downturn. It's a easy way to sort of look at the big picture. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. Senator Hoffman? I'll just pause for one moment. It's very difficult for the general public to follow along when we put out a variety of different bottom line numbers. And so these are numbers that we have used to put Alaska's best foot forward to credit rating agencies and bonding agencies. As we start to get heated towards our differences of opinions between two bodies as we approach solving Alaska's problems, I'll just point out for the public that we all see these numbers differently, and Senator Michicki rightly points out that currently the price is exceeding our projection for per barrel, and production in our oil basin is up for its third year in a row, projected to be up. And so those are positive numbers, but our job as the Finance Committee, both on in the other body and here, is to have the argument here at the table, but try to come together with one set of facts and one set of numbers for the people to consider, because it is difficult to follow our conversation sometimes. So I'm happy to have the additional conversation, but I hope that the media, as they put out those different perspectives, understand that the numbers are confusing for a layman who is going to work every day, maybe two or three jobs, trying to get bits and pieces picked up from Channel 2, Channel 11, their favorite cable channel, you know, reading different media news outlets. And so the legislature is working hard to find a set of data points that we can agree to so that the facts look similar. And so I just point that only, Senator Machicki, again, because this is one way to look at it, and I'm sure our colleagues in the other body will have a different way to support their belief that that there are taxes that are needed to be had in our state. And that's a valid conversation. It's a valid perspective. I certainly don't agree with that perspective, and the Senate has not agreed with that perspective. But it's an argument that people are having in all of Alaskans' communities. Mr. Mitchell, I'm sorry to Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it is an interesting chart to look at. But when you look at fiscal year 19, the legislature has not come up with a split on what the portion of the POMV will go toward state operations and what portion would go toward dividends. And you look at those two numbers, and that's $2.2 billion. And in 19, if you if any one of those changes slightly, we could be in a deficit situation. So I think it's it is the thing that is facing us this session, is what piece of this pie will be utilized for state government and what piece of the pie will be used for the people. You know, we are an owner state, and there's been a lot of discussion at this table, in this building, and throughout the general public on what is the ideal solution, and that is the problem that we are facing today. You know, I think we have not taken a vote on overriding the governor's veto, but the people are still looking for us for a financial solution. And that, I think, is one of the key points that we must wrestle with and decide. I don't believe that we can decide on one and not deal with the other.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Mr. Mitchell, please continue.
So like I said, it was an important slide. This is another one of the slides we had in our presentation, and it dovetails with that concept of diversification with an endowment model that the state of Alaska, with, at the time, $61.5 billion invested in 3,000 corporations around the world, really isn't reliant on its state economy for revenue generation for some significant portion of its need. And that diversification of revenue stream is a credit strength. It's obviously an incredible strength that everybody recognizes. And I don't know that there's any other explanation needed there. This slide was intended to try to approach that narrow economy with reliance on oil. And there was actually a piece last summer by Neil Fried in the Department of Labor that discussed GDP, Alaskan GDP. And I guess I was a little surprised that oil represented about 13-14% of GDP at this point. That was a decline. It had declined from about 26% of GDP, and this isn't on this slide. But that decline is based on the reduction in the price of oil and some of the retrenchment that you've seen by the industry. And that other than that oil GDP, the other portions of the GDP had all grown on a nominal basis. And so there had been growth in other sectors of the economy, which, again, is kind of surprising. I'm not an economist. I just look at economists' work occasionally. But the stability that's existed in the state despite all of the negative news, I mean, and again, unemployment, we now have the unemployment, and this is in the upper left, the highest in, at the time, 7.2%, highest unemployment in the country. Well, what changed? Well, we didn't really change very much here in the state of Alaska. You know, we went from an unemployment rate that was a little bit lower, but what changed is that the national economy improved hugely. They went from 10% down to 4%. And so that's why, I mean, we were, you know, we looked good when we were at 8% back in 2012. Now we were below that from an unemployment perspective, but now we're worse than the national average, and so we're highlighted for having high unemployment. The stability that in the chart, the number of years that the state added jobs, we have an average of 89% of the time the state's added jobs over the 1961 to 2016 time frame, which the U.S. average is 82%. So, again, that's stability. That's something that we want to highlight as being good. The single-family home prices that we've talked about, reduced population in the state, and wouldn't you have expected that to correlate to housing prices? And while I would say that I believe that housing prices are fairly flat, I haven't seen a reduction in housing prices that somebody's been saying that they're underwater on their house and unable to sell it, for example, like you saw in 2008. And so it's just intriguing to me. If those people were living in man camps or renting a room in somebody's house or in a hotel or where they were living, but you would have expected that there would have been a reduction in single-family home prices if the reduction in population were as significant as some of the numbers imply, which, again, this is a stability factor that we try to highlight. And then the pie chart that shows where jobs are and just the diversity of colors in there, expressing that we do have a small, but in our view, something that we can argue is a diverse economy.
Senator Bishop.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. It's a good chart for people to look at. It's there's no revelations here other than we're a resource state. We're always going to be a resource state unless we have some divine inspiration that will allow us to grow our economy. You look where the jobs are in Alaska, and if you were to do the same chart for the jobs in the lower 48, you'd see the diversity of an economy. So we're a lot better off in the banking industry than we were in 1985. We learned our lessons. That's why you didn't have the percentage of homes going underwater, so I won't wax any more poetic, but thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. I would point out that this is a great conversation, looking at the upper left-hand slide on the unemployment rate in Alaska. And what struck me on this particular slide was numbers can say anything you want. If we just compare ourselves to the continental United States or the rest of America, their unemployment is 4.4, and ours looks incredibly high at 7.2. But if you look over a 10-year period, our unemployment rate hasn't changed much, which is a much broader view. So it struck me that numbers can tell you anything you want, depending on which perspective you want to look at it. So I think it's a great piece of information to provide the credit rating agencies to have them look fairly on Alaska when they view unemployment. But for those who don't have a job, it's critically important. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to play off your statement just then, I looked at a chart the other day that had a 30-year timeline of unemployment in Alaska, because you hear people say two things, that we spend the most per capita of any state in the nation, and we have the highest unemployment. But it's just largely due to the seasonality of our employment, where over the 30-year time period, it looks similar, other than times of extreme recession in the lower 48. Unfortunately, because of the type of economy that we have here, we're always, generally, the highest for unemployment. And they rated us very high during some of the times that we had the highest unemployment for Alaska, although at that time we were below the national average. So it's just it's an interesting relationship that I think we don't take into account as often as we should.
Well done, Mr. Mitchell. Please continue.
And so those were the excerpt slides that we had. If anybody wants to see that rating agency presentation, I'd be happy to provide it for you or further. Yeah, okay.
and then I won't make everyone else do it, but I would love to.
Okay, I will get that to you. So these last two slides are just, I was asked to include something about the Alaska Tax Credit Purchase Proposal that the governor's introduced legislation to allow. And so I can address it from just that debt perspective, not from a policy perspective or otherwise. But from that debt perspective, there are some comparables, I hate to say it, but to the pension obligation bond proposal, there's also some stark differences that I think are important to highlight. But generally, we have an existing liability on our balance sheet. We have a statutory commitment to pay that liability over a defined period of time. That does evolve as we go through time, as our revenue projections go up, the statutory payment to the tax credit liability goes up, and as our revenue goes, and this is generally, as our revenue goes down, the expected payment goes down. There's a number of reasons for undertaking this, but from my view, it is that I've had some conversations with some folks that are involved in the financing of companies that have done work on the slope, and they financed work based on an expectation of a prior practice of the state of paying for these credits annually. And so both the firms doing that work as well as credit providers had this anticipated short-term recouping of expenditures, which when the state's revenues diminished, there were hard decisions to be made, and one of them was that the state couldn't afford to make those extraordinary payments out of its current year revenues and had to revert to the minimalistic payments that were defined in statute. So that led to it has led to stress for some firms as well as some financing entities, and so an ability to provide an alternative to those firms is beneficial as they are working in the industry that generates the majority or all of our unrestricted general fund revenue. And so that's something that can be held up as a valuable goal. The cash flows that are expected at this point in time based on the fall revenue sources book projection are fairly steep, and this slide is the final slide was generated to try to show that. So the purple in the charts on the left-hand side, and there's two charts because there's two kind of bookends on the scenario that's been proposed. So the purple is the existing projected cash flows for the credits. And that what's being proposed is that purple payment stream be present valued on using a discount rate. So it would be an annualized discount on those future cash flows, which means that in today's dollars, like if you owed $100 to somebody and you're going to discount that cash flow at 10% annually and it's not due until next year, you're only going to pay them $90 today because you had a 10% discount on that price, and if it was multi-year, then there would be multiple years of discounting that would occur. And so that purple cash flow can be refinanced, and that's how I think about it coming from, again, the debt side. But that initial benefit is where this proposal differs fairly significantly from the pension obligation bond proposal, that there was no opportunity to buy out an existing liability at a discounted rate. It was just refinancing an existing liability using a different interest rate than we're assuming the liability carries right now. So that discounting is fairly critical to being able to extend cash flow. So the blue and kind of the various shades of blue and green that are in the bar charts that go from 19 to 30, FY 19 to 30, that's the replacement cash flows that would occur instead of the purple cash flows. So from a budgetary perspective, you're deferring expenditure for a number of years. And there are benefits to doing that, again, since we're, as discussed earlier, a state that relies on investment income from reserves to pay for expenditures. And so retaining money in reserves that are expected to yield a higher rate than our cost of capital is beneficial to the state from a financial planning perspective. It, from a budgetary perspective, becomes more manageable. You talk about looking at future expected annualized revenue, and there are some increases in annualized revenue, and this, from a budgetary perspective, is easier to afford, if you will, than the proposed blue bar charts, easier to afford than the purple charts. It's kind of like if you're buying a house and you can afford to pay in 15 years or you have to pay in 30 years. And at the same time, I guess, in that example, you would have a trust fund. So maybe nobody has a trust fund, but if you did, and that trust fund was invested in a diversified asset allocation that you expected to earn somewhere around 7 to 10%, and you could borrow money at 3%, you probably would, because it's just smart. You have long-term views in both of your accounts. It's a long-term purchase. It's a long-term investment, and there's a mismatch that you expect to occur one to the other that's going to be financially advantageous to you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Great, thank you. So, Mr. Mitchell, these graphs with their purple and blue are very helpful, and I really appreciate you presenting those. It actually makes it a lot easier to kind of see both the scale as well as the timing of the payments. So, how I'm reading this is that the state of Alaska will initially negotiate with the receivers of the tax credits, the oil companies, for either 5 or 10% discount rate or something in between. And then once that's done, we kind of have our number of what we need to bond. And then we go out to the initial market and see what kind of rates that we can get. And we lock into those rates. And that's the rate that we pay. It's a fixed rate for the course of the bonds. And we're not really going to know those rates until we actually go out and lock those in. And we have a rising inflationary environment, which is actually good for the state of Alaska. But in your opinion, so I have two questions. If we do not pass a POMV, do we have the capacity to do this? If we do pass a POMV, does that, in your opinion, help with the type of rate that we might get back, i.e. a much better, healthier one, and from our perspective, because investors will see that we have a viable source of repayment?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. So the first question, I think, is could we do this with our existing debt capacity? If you looked at the debt affordability book, you'd say no. Well, but there's nuance to that, because this is an existing liability. So we, a couple of years ago, we're going to do a pension obligation bond for a couple of billion dollars, $2 to $3 billion. And that transaction was being structured in all the right ways, meaning that there was a deferral of of potential benefit to the back end. You weren't avoiding a payment in the front end, so you weren't borrowing long to avoid a current year expenditure. There were conservative assumptions throughout the structuring. One of the rating agencies was going to have a one-notch downgrade from that magnitude of financing. The other two were okay because they recognized it as a refinancing of an existing liability. So the other day, last Wednesday, I think, I said it does have the potential to impact our debt capacity, but it's not a one-for-one basis. It's not the same as if we were issuing debt to build a new facility somewhere. I think it is likely affordable in the current environment that we're in from a rating perspective, but it would probably limit other alternatives that the state would have available to it at the current rating level to issue debt. As far as if we passed a POMV, would that be beneficial? Well, certainly if the credit rating of the state was on firmer ground, it would obviously help the transaction. As far as what that might correlate to, I'm not really certain. Rates are very compressed right now, meaning rates are low, and so rating differentials tend to be not as great as you see in a high-rate environment just because the percentage spread from one to the other is less because rates are so low. But there certainly would be a benefit to having a stronger credit position. And then finally, I mean, the legislation as drafted does allow both fixed-rate and variable-rate debt to be considered. And so there would be a decision matrix that have to be thrown together. I mean, there is an argument to be made that variable debt might be a better means of financing this because you would expect your fixed income return to go up if your variable rate debt payments were to go up because of a rising interest rate environment. And so there's I think all of our modeling that we've done has been based on a fixed rate issue. But there is room for a conversation to occur. And then finally, I just point out that this little chart is very generalistic. There are many different people that hold these credits, and we don't know who's going to be in, who's going to be out, who's going to be in at what rate, if they're going to be in this year but not next year, or not this year but next year. I mean, there's all or none components, but if they have a credit that's payable in FY19, then there's this all or none concept baked into the legislation right now. You're in for all of the credits that you have that would be paid over whichever current and future fiscal years, or you're out. But then next year you might accrue additional credits that you could again make that decision. Are you in or are you out? And so we don't, this assumes everybody's in. And we don't know who's in and who's out. And then to the extent people aren't in, the legislation doesn't allow us to borrow for the current year's credit payment. So, because that would be a partial in, right? And so my points are that this is a simplistic analysis of a very complex, even when you try to analyze it, it's difficult because of the different ways that this could evolve.
Senator Von Imhoff, follow up?
No, thank you.
Mr. Mitchell, could you tell Alaskans, I know that we've adopted a policy, I believe I found it in the debt affordability analysis, but when you talk about affordability for the state, we're talking about actually working within a particular set of parameters, a range per se of percentages based on revenue volatility. And so when we talk about affordability, we're talking about targeting the state's debt between 5% and 8%. Is that still the accurate percentages?
Madam Chair, yes.
And so just like those of you at home, I know when I went to buy my first house, to stay within that, if you wanted to have a car payment or whatever, the banks might see what you could afford differently than what you are willing to change your living circumstances to be able to provide a roof over your head for your family. And what I mean is that it's all subjective again, but it is good best practice that we've adopted a policy and that we target all that we do to stay within those parameters of either 5% or 8% based on the revenue that the state of Alaska is seeing. So I just want to reassure Alaskans that we are within that realm. Is that accurate this year or slightly outside of it, Mr. Devin?
Madam Chair, we're above our metrics right now. Our projections are that primarily based on declining annual debt service that we would be within our metrics within 2 years on the debt that goes into the 5% level, and I think it's 3 or 4 on the 8% level obligations, which includes the school debt reimbursement program.
Mr. Mitchell, and does that include current projections for revenue? So if revenue goes up in any particular way, then or debt goes down, that those percentages would be affected?
Through the chair, Madam Chair, it does, yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Senator Machicki.
Thank you. So from a credit rating perspective, I mean, you talked about this not being a one-to-one because it's not new debt. It's not like a bridge. This is booked in the CAFR, State's Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. And considering the discount, and it seems to the cash flow helps us by reducing UGF, $175 million in 19, $140 in 20, $60 million in 21. It matches the call for the extended cash payments out when we expect to be in a much better financial position from a credit rating perspective. Do they get into that level of detail? Would this be regarded as a positive step or stable or a negative impact on our rating?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, that's a good question. That the one discussion that you would hear with pension obligation bonds a lot was this concept of a soft liability, that making the actuarially determined contributions to pension trusts is an annual appropriation that can occur or not. You might have, in our instance, a constitutional protection for those benefits to be paid to those beneficiaries, but the actual funding of that trust can occur or not. And so once you issue debt, it becomes a hard liability, and that hard liability concept is that you have now a bond that you would have to pay on, or if you did not, you chose not to, there would be a credit default with all of the negative ramifications that go along with that. As far as I'm losing my train of thought on the second part of your question. I'm sorry.
Well, you were heading down the right road, but just, I mean, we maybe perhaps didn't quite get there, just on the fact that it is book debt, which I guess you're calling a soft debt, that it transfers to a harder debt once you have a bond repayment requirement. So does a credit rating agency, considering it improves our cash flow, particularly in the first 4 or 5 years, the times when we're most challenged financially, does it balance out as a positive from a credit rating aspect or not?
Mm-hmm. And through the chair, Senator Machicki, maybe that's why I hesitated, is because it's a difficult question to answer, that there are positives and negatives about it. That I do agree that the management of a known cash flow through the use of debt is there's an argument for credit positive. But the rating analysts, I don't believe, I don't see the credit payment requirement included in their debt metrics at this point. And so while it's a liability that's on our balance sheet that we have an annual obligation, statutory annual obligation to consider paying, they're not including it as a metric because most states don't have oil and gas tax credit programs. And so it doesn't fit onto their scorecard. And so that's where we would be obligated to make the arguments that you just laid out, why this would be something that should be construed as credit neutral to credit positive rather than something that you just say, oh, you added general fund supported debt net tax supported debt, and therefore it's credit bad from a debt affordability perspective. And so it would be my perspective that we would be able to successfully argue that this would be credit neutral to credit positive, even though it diminished in some way our debt capacity at the same time.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Von Imhoff.
This is not going to be, thank you, ma'am. This won't be our last conversation on this topic, so I'll save my comments for the full meeting.
Please go ahead.
Well, we've already paid this bill once, and it's all hypothetical, this whole conversation we're having. I just worry in the future when you're looking at financing a natural gas pipeline, that people are going to look and say, oh, they're welching, so we're only going to get 90 cents on the dollar, so let's build 110% into our bid going forward.
Thank you, Senator Bishop.
I can.
And that's related to the discount that the governor's proposing. Senator Von Imhoff.
Mr. Mitchell, on the right-hand side, you have cohort one, and if we're looking at a 10-year, I'm assuming that takes in the at least a 10-year term when you're evaluating it. Are those real dollars or nominal dollars? Because I think in this expected inflationary environment, that is material, especially over a 10-year term. Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that's present value dollars. And so taking those future cash flows, and so there's, like I said earlier, there would be a diminished nominal cost of a payment in 2028, for example, versus 2019. And to address, I know Senator Bishop didn't ask a specific question, more of a comment, but I have had some discussions with not really the firms that have conducted the work as much as the firms that have financed some of the firms that have done the work. And the feedback that I've had in those very limited conversations is that any proposal is better than the status quo, meaning that if there is a discount, they'd rather consider the option, and they can do the math themselves and figure out what's beneficial to them, versus if we're just going to be in the statutory payment, the purple payment bars option. And I would imagine you'd respond and say it should all be paid right now, and so that's the alternatives, I guess. Again, the bookends, you know, pay the entire accrued liability today, or pay with the purple bar charts, or offer an alternative that you can have a diminished payment today that results in some version of, you know, some mix between the two, depending on who's in and who's out.
Follow-up, Senator Bishop?
No, we got other business. I'll keep my comments to myself.
Senator Bishop, it's an important topic. Mr. Mitchell, do we have the slide electronically so that we can reproduce it? I would just follow up on Senator Bishop's comments in that I know it's a policy decision for us for consideration, and this particular slide gives us great information to base a decision on, but in reference to Senator Bishop, the governor's budget that has come forward has no payment included except the debt service. So even though the legislation proposes a May, it really is a shall if there's no backup money to pay those who are waiting in line right now and ready to do that. So I understand it's a policy decision, and from some of us at this table, we've tried to pay those payments multiple times. The governor may see it as a positive from past vetoes, but we tried to pay those payments twice so that we wouldn't have the backlog that's currently facing us today. So it's just it was a different perspective. So we'll deal with the parameters that we have in front of us today. But it's a little disheartening for the budget not to contain the statutory minimums required and basing it off of legislation that the administration has not been able to pass in previous years, some of the budget assumptions. But again, that's a conversation for a different day and not in your wheelhouse. We do appreciate the clarity on the situation. With that, we'll take a brief at ease while we change out our presenters. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. If you're joining us off net or online, this is Senate Finance. It's still February 7th, 2018. The next item before us is Senate Bill number 125. If I could invite Senator Pete Kelly to the microphone, as well as his staff, Joseph Barnes. Burns? Mr. Burns. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. May I testify?
Please present your bill, 125.
All right. For the record, I'm Senator Pete Kelly, covering District A, which is the city of Fairbanks and North Pole and Fort Wainwright, portion of North Pole. Madam Chair, members of the Senate Finance Committee, thank you for hearing the bill. Deeply appreciate it. It's important to my community. Senate Bill 125 extends the time for ADA to issue bonds for the Interior Energy Project by 5 years to June 30th, 2023. As you know, the Interior suffers from the most volatile energy costs in the Rail Belt, and as a result of cold winters and high prices, residents also burn a lot of wood and coal, which exacerbates the problem additionally by air quality issues as well. It is due to these issues that we, along with Governor Parnell in 2013, put together a package in the form of SB 23, and SB 23 was a funding package. The funding included $57 million in capital grants, $125 million in SETS loans, of which about $52.8 million has been spent, and $45 million remains available. And, of course, the $150 million in ADA bonding authority, and that is the subject of the bill before you. The distribution system we have in place, due to limited liquefaction and storage infrastructure, has never exceeded about 70 miles of pipe, with no more than about 1,200 customers. Many of the current customers are commercial in nature, and many of them have interruptible service due to the lack of sufficient backup storage capacity. This structure has made it challenging to create an expanded distribution network for other interior residents and businesses. For a community that supports two major military installation bases, this has created some significant issues for us in our economy. Madam Chair, the ADA team overseeing the IEP, which is the Interior Energy Project, has been advancing the original financing package, but just as they were ready to deploy the $150 million bond component, again, the source of this bill, we have essentially run out of time on the legislative authorization. The bonding is absolutely necessary for the completion of the project, and it will be used to increase the production capacity of the LNG plant at Point McKenzie and further the expansion of the distribution network. I want to emphasize that this bonding authorization can only be used for the purposes of the Interior Energy Project due to amendments that were made to the project in the form of HB 105 in 2015. The bonding can also only be used to finance investment-grade utility infrastructure due to covenants, including the agreement signed by ADA and the IGU. Just to give you an update to date, number one, 2014 and 15, there was a build-out of the natural gas distribution system covering nearly all of Fairbanks and the core, of North Pole. In 2015, ADA purchased the Pentex assets, including the LNG production facility at Point McKenzie, the LNG trailers, and local distribution infrastructure. The passage last spring of PACE legislation assisted commercial customers in conversion to LNG, to natural gas. And then last September, ADA secured gas supply agreements with Hillcorp. In addition, there was in December, we consolidated the Fairbanks Natural Gas Company, which was the company that was currently in place, and IGU, which was is a utility that's been created, and they've been merged into a single investment grade gas utility, and that was through the sale of the Pentex assets that was accomplished. This month, construction is now underway on the large scale 5.2 million dollar LNG storage facility in South Fairbanks, and it'll support the customer growth that we will anticipate from the availability of the gas. Even with the recent fall in heating prices, the need for a long-term, clean, affordable gas in Fairbanks is necessary. And on its present schedule, the first expanded availability with potential to move interruptible customers to full service is expected in 2019, and by 2020 we'll see the first full-scale efforts to convert properties with access to existing distribution systems. Madam Chair, somewhat simple bill, extending an authorization that I think we've all agreed is a necessary project for the Interior. And I see former President Terrio is here also to answer questions. So.
Are there questions for Senator Kelly? Senator Bishop?
Just a comment. I know the Senator mentioned about the, you know, the price of fuel in Fairbanks, and with the run-up in crude oil prices, delivered fuel to my house last week in Fairbanks was $2.86 a gallon. So our prices are headed north again, and this is just one more reason why we went down this road 4 years ago.
Senator Leinenhoff.
Senator Kelly, I don't know if you know this or if Mr. Terrio knows this, but is there a long-term contract with the gas supplier in South Central Alaska?
Senator Terrio is probably better at filling out your knowledge on the Hillcorp agreement.
Okay. Is there any further questions on the structure of the bill and what the bill does? Senator Kelly, did you have a comment?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Joe, did you want to put yourself on the record?
For the record, Joe Burns, Office of Senator Pete Kelly. I did want to note the that in front of you, you should have a CS that was passed out of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. And the only change from the bill that was introduced on the floor to the CS is a title change, which just cleared up some ambiguity in the original title.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. And I think I probably helped with some of that. I asked who the what entity was actually financing the bonds there, and so that's been cleared up in the title of who would handle that transaction. Thank you, Senator Kelly. Thank you, Mr. Burns.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I'd like to open the public hearing on the CS for Senate Bill number 125, Community and Regional Affairs, /U. This is an act extending the expiration date of authorizing to finance and issue bonds through the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority for a liquefied natural gas production system and natural gas distribution system for an interior energy project and providing for an effective date. Mr. Terrio?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Gene Terrio for ADA. And to the previously asked question, the current gas supply that was secured from Hillcorp was for a three-year period of time. We, as we actually negotiated, were offered a longer-term contract, but IGU, the entity that is purchasing and consolidating the utilities, asked us not to lock them in for a longer period of time. So the ADA board decided that 3 years with potential extensions was acceptable. That does allow IGU the ability to look to other potential sources out of Cook Inlet that may actually lower the price of gas. But because in 2015, when House Bill 105 was passed, the legislature put a number of requirements on the ADA board. One of them was that they had to see a supply of gas, understand all the components of the infrastructure, and have an estimation of the delivered city gate price. So that was necessary. So that's what the gas supply that we got with Hillcorp allowed us to bring those different components into what was called the Hospital 105 plan, showing that we could meet the target of energy price delivered to a residential customer, and allowed Ada then the access to the finance tools that Senator Kelly just went over. That supply contract did bring a number of positive things to an enterprise. Number one, there's no take or pay obligation to accommodate the growth that we anticipate. There's quite a bit of flexibility that Hillcorp has offered to the enterprise. And again, we do have options to extend that contract by five-year blocks going forward if IGU doesn't find other sources that have more benefits to the project.
Senator Von Imhoff, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. So, Mr. Cherio, when is the current contract's expiration date? And then if there is an option to do five-year blocks of extension, will the terms remain the same as they are now, or will they need to be renegotiated for the next 5 years?
Madam Chairman, the contract started on January 1st, I believe. No, I'm sorry. We actually were able to start it earlier. The old contract was supposed to end the end of March. This new one, I believe, starts at that time, but we avoided a 3% increase in the old contract on January 1st. So it's 3 years from the end of March. We have, in order to get increased capacity, we just have to give the producer 18 months advance notice. We want the increased capacity. And for the five-year extensions, I believe the terms can be renegotiated. However, at this point, I mean, there was no discussion about reopening all those terms, but I believe the producer would be amenable to consideration of possible requests. There just has not been a commitment at this point.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So to confirm, then, it looks like it's the current contract will expire in 2021, and then at that time, both parties will meet to discuss capacity, terms, et cetera.
Yes, that's when it turns out. However, with existing customers, the utility will have to start those discussions well before the end of the contract, just so we can show the RCA that we do have contracted gas in place. You can't go right up to that cutoff date. We'll have to start those discussions sooner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, did you have testimony that you'd like to provide the committee?
No, Madam Chairman, just to primarily answer questions.
Are there other questions? Well, we can bring Mr. Terrio back to the table. We do have multiple people waiting online to testify. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Terrio, I'm not familiar with this, but does this provide for all of the energy needs of the two bases? I would think that would be pretty crucial to the security of the bases, if that's true.
Madam Chairman, at this point, we have not anticipated use on the bases. We do know at Fort Wainwright, though, they have some other facility that is across the river and is not heated with a distributed heat loop off their power plant. That power plant, of course, runs on coal. It's very tough to compete against the price of BTU generated with coal. So there are some of the infrastructure at Wainwright that we know can avail itself of pipe distribution. Eielson is about 7 miles from North Pole. There has been some estimation of the cost of what it would take to pipe energy out there. However, most of the facilities on Eielson also are heated with a distributed heat loop. And so unless or until they decide that they need to go to a different source of generation for the bases, we're not anticipating use. But we hope to pick up some use, for some of the facilities where it would make economic sense for them. We've also in the past responded to a request from the Department of Energy looking at the interest of changing the heat source or the energy source for Fort Greeley. They did put out an RFP about a year and a half ago, just wondering who's out there that might have the capability. And so although there would not be a capability of pushing gas via a pipe distribution system from the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the Fort Greeley area could source LNG, perhaps, out of the plant, plant expansion. And it's all very much a volume enterprise. The higher you can get the volume, the lower you can get the per unit cost.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Just for the committee, I did ask in the Community and Regional Affairs if there were any anchor tenants, and there are people who are interested in gas, but not really any anchor tenants like the ones that we would think of for industry. Mr. Terrio, has that changed since the Community and Regional Affairs? You mentioned a retailer or small box stores might be interested in something, but no anchor tenants like a mine or like the military bases.
Nobody that is stepped forward at this time, but we do know that mining operations up the Dalton Highway have been watching this program very closely to see what the delivered price in the community would be, bulk LNG, knowing that once that is available to them, they can start to run the economics for continuing, you know, to drive it a little further distance to deliver it. So there have been expressions of interest, but up until the fall of the end of 2017, we didn't have a price really that they could really crunch numbers on.
Thank you, Senator Terrio. And I asked in Community and Regional Affairs what the cost was of the gas to consumers, if you had an anticipated price. You answered that to me. I just wanted to put that on the record for the Senate Finance Committee to understand the cost.
Yes, Madam Chairman, and I do have copies out of what was called the House Bill 105 plan. It's the document that the ADA board used that shows that right now our delivered price is over $20 per MCF of gas. That is equivalent of $2.77 fuel oil, as Senator Bishop indicated. The price delivered to a residential customer right now is above that for fuel oil. We believe once we have the capability of actually serving currently interruptible customers and hooking up new residential customers, in 2020 the price starts to come down to initially $17.31 per MCF of gas. Ultimately, in the year 2022, we are down to $15.48. 2023, $15.11. And so that's roughly equivalent to $2 fuel oil.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Mr. Terrio, I appreciate those numbers, saying that the costs are going to go down over time. But generally, I would think that with trucking and rail, the costs could potentially actually go up because of liability, insurance, benefits for labor costs, et cetera. Is there any room in this project to revisit a fixed pipeline that, while might be expensive up front, is a fixed asset that can be depreciated over time? And in conjunction with the Trump administration several trillion-dollar infrastructure package, that this could be an opportunity to build a just-in-time delivery between Cook Inlet and Fairbanks and Interior that is arguably a better option over the long term and safer, and again, just-in-time delivery, so there's less aspect for storage and so forth.
Mr. Terrio.
Madam Chairman, at this point, deploying these tools, we are focused on an LNG delivery. We have in the past looked at pipe delivery up from Cook Inlet, and in fact, crunch numbers, I think it was in 2014 going into 2015, I think was the last time we looked at it. Part of the difficulty is the seasonal swing up in Fairbanks on energy demand, and so you have to have pipe capacity or compression on a pipe so you can basically triple the delivery into the community during the dead of winter versus the trough in the middle of summer. And so while there were proposals that, well, you can just use plastic pipe for delivery, once we determined exactly how you would have to compress that up, a single plastic pipe didn't cut it. You'd have to actually put two plastic pipes in the trench. And so all of your financing was basically eaten up in that delivery into the interior, and you didn't have financing then for any build-out of the distribution system. We believe we basically are building, you know, the distribution system that's initially fed via LNG, that hopefully will ultimately be fed off of a big pipeline, taking the tremendous resource of the North Slope across the state and then serving the interior via a lateral off of that. Right now, if such a infrastructure presented itself tomorrow, we don't have the infrastructure in the community to use the resource. It would be years before we'd have that in place. We're building that now ahead of delivery across the state.
Mr. Terrio, given the other folks waiting in the queue and discussion on the bill, if we could move into public testimony and then we'll bring you back to the microphone if we have further questions. Would that work for senators? With that, the next person, I believe, online and waiting to testify is Jomo Stewart. He's the general manager of the Interior Gas Utility. Mr. Stewart, welcome to Senate Finance. Your testimony for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jomo Stewart. I'm the general manager for the Interior Gas Utility. Honestly, ma'am, Senator Kelly and Mr. Terrio have done a fine job of just kind of giving me the parameters of the request and the need, and so I would just be available to answer questions, except to say thank you very much to the sponsor, and thank you in advance to the committee, hopefully for a favorable consideration. Thanks, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Next online, Jim Dotson, the president of Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. Mr. Dotson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Dotson, president of Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. I appreciate the opportunity to talk in support of Senate Bill 2125. I too, in the interest of your time and the long time you've already spent, would like to associate myself with Senator Terrio's comments. This has been a long time project for Fairbanks, and it is supported by far by the majority of the community. I would encourage the committee's support, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance. Jim Matherly, the mayor of Fairbanks. Mayor Matherly, welcome to
Senate. Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning to the committee and everyone else listening. Jim Matherly, Fairbanks City Mayor. In the spirit of time, as the gentleman who spoke before me, I align myself with Senator Kelly, Senator Bishop's comments, Mr. Terrio's comments. We're very excited in Fairbanks for this. I wholeheartedly speak in support of Senate Bill 125. Hope you can do the same. We're on the precipice of a great event for Fairbanks. It's been a very long time coming, so I do appreciate everyone's work. And to this bill sponsors, my hat's off to you. Thank you so much.
Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, the next person online from Fairbanks, John Cook from Airport Equipment Rentals. Mr. Cook, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is John Cook. I'm CFO for Airport Equipment Rentals and also CFO for other real estate entities that are owned by Jerry Sadler, which owns all those entities. I just wanted to take a moment to express support for SB 125 and echo many of the previous comments that have been made. We are not only large users of natural gas, but through our real estate entities, we own large tracts of retail land that would be used to construct box stores. Because of the limited F&G system that was in place, we haven't been able to add any new stores at all since 2013. You know, the completion of this package will allow tankage to be completed and other expansions to be made that can serve future box store customers. We've got folks that are ready to talk about coming to Fairbanks. We're in negotiations with them now, and being able to have certainty that we can bring those projects home in 2019 is critical to our company and beneficial to the Fairbanks economy in terms of construction jobs and retail jobs. Thank you for your time, and again, I hope you can support this bill today.
Are there questions from committee members? John, thanks for calling into Senate Finance today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else wishing to testify on the CS for Senate Bill number 125/U? Anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Mr. Terrio, would you like to join us back at the table? Senator Bishop, could you cover the fiscal notes for us?
Yes, ma'am. committee members. Let's see. The title is Extend Bond Authority for Interior Energy Project. It is a zero fiscal note. Just would note that passage of the bill will not change the amount or restricted use of the existing bond authorization for the Interior Energy Project, would simply allow more time for the bonds to be used. And I just want to reemphasize, will not change the amount or restricted use. So, and it is a zero fiscal note, ma'am. And Departments, Community and Economic Development, and the OMB component number is 1234.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. I would note on page 2 that the principal amount of the bonds authorized may not exceed $150 million plus the cost of capitalized interest, bond council fees, trustee fees, rating fees, financial investor fees, escrow costs, and other bonding issuance costs that the authority considers reasonable and appropriate. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Terrio, as you look at this project, and you've seen many projects come through, are there any private investors that are involved with the essentially the entity that's getting this $150 million of ADA funds?
Madam Chairman, or to the question through the chair, there are not. At one point, we had put out an RFP. We were anticipating working with Salix, which is a company out of the Pacific Northwest, also the owner of the utilities, electric utilities here in Juneau. As we worked with them, it was determined that the addition of their participation brought corporate taxes that had to be covered, property taxes that had to be covered. And with the price of fuel oil being down and the expectation that conversions may take a little bit longer a period of time, that brought additional economic stress to the project. And so there was a request for Salix to step away. They did agree to do that. And so now we're left basically with the ADA-owned infrastructure, the local government-formed utility. The proposal is to combine those two under local control, so there's not a private sector player in the mix at this point.
I can continue, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, follow up.
As we go ahead and look at the price of oil hovering in this area for an extended period of time, is there a concern that the economy of Fairbanks may take, may be stressed beyond its point to be able to pay back these bonds?
Now, Senator, to the Senator's question through the chair, we believe that the House Bill 105, the numbers that I read to you, are based on only 50% of the potential customers actually hooking up. Originally, when we started the project, there was an anticipation that the price of fuel was presented enough of a delta to what we thought we'd deliver natural gas, that we would get upwards of 70 to 75% of the customers as the pipe goes down the street to hook up. Because that delta was smaller, we actually backed that down to just 50%. And you can see, again, we believe we can get to the target numbers. The IGU actually ran crunch numbers on only 35% of the customers hooking up. And even at that very low, what we believe to be a conservative estimate, it was shown that the project would be able to pay its bills, pay back any bonds that are used. They might not be able to build the further distribution out quite as quickly as they wanted, would like to serve more customers, but they would be able to pay the debt service on the enterprise.
Senator Olson, please continue.
As you look at the dollar that bought it back in 2013 when the initial bill was passed, and you look at that in 2023, does inflation cause you concern that you won't be able to access some of those people that are maybe out toward the periphery that are in very much need of natural gas?
Well, certainly, and as we negotiated for the consolidation of the two utilities, one of the things that former Senator Gary Wilkin, who's on the ADA board, was insistent on is that the contractual documents have a number of covenants in there by which IGU has to operate the combined utility as an investment-grade utility that will sort of limit or their, not their ability, but they won't be able to borrow and push the system out beyond what they can show to be an economically reasonable. We believe that that's actually the type of thing that a bond council would be looking for as far as a solid, sound business plan. But because of former Senator Wilkins' concern, we actually wrote a number of those covenants right into the contractual agreement for the sale of Pentex consolidation into a single utility to make sure that they're not overinvesting, not pushing, not stressing the enterprise by taking on a debt unwisely.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. For the record here at Senate Finance, could you tell the people of Alaska how much money we've invested in the state has invested in the interior energy project?
As Senator Kelly indicated, the original financing plan was $57.5 million of capital grants, allowance for $125 million of SETS financing, and at the time a specific appropriation was put into the SETS fund for that purpose, and then the potential for the $150 million of bonds. At this point, none of the bonds have been accessed. That's why we're asking for the additional time, and only part of the SETS monies have been used. Under the contractual agreements that were signed in mid-December, all of the capital money will be deployed, and about $70 to $80 million of the SETS funds.
Thank you, and that totals $337,500,000 for state support of the project. There is another aspect that the state has been involved in, and that's storage for the interior. Can you tell us what's been done from the state's investment on storage and if that's becoming an issue for you?
Yes, Madam Chairman. As Senator Kelly indicated, we just recently pulled the trigger on the sizing up of the storage. Of the existing infrastructure right now, storage is the bottleneck. We can actually serve more customers with the small plant that we have in Mat-Su. Except we have to have 5 days of product in the community to be able to serve customers if there's an interruption. And because of the limited LNG storage capacity right now and the lack of a place to store LNG that we can produce in the summer while demand is low and stockpile, that presents the biggest bottleneck right now. So with the sizing up of storage, and that project is underway now, we will actually be able to serve more customers with the small plant that we have, and then consider when the economics are right to increase the LNG capacity, because we will then have the thermos bottle basically in the community to stockpile the product in the summer for demand, peak demand in the winter.
And has the state granted bonds for support of storage facilities in the interior?
No, Madam Chairman. At this point, the financing for the storage is utilization of some of the SETS authorization.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? With that, we will set this bill aside and ask for any amendments by 5 o'clock today. If you have any concerns, please let me know. And you can look for this bill to be heard or brought back before us either tomorrow or the next day. So under bills previously heard. With that, we're adjourned.